I am master of my life. Believe it or not. I am master of my life. This is Dr. Herbert L. Byerly bringing you the thought for today from Campo, California, paradise on earth. I am master of my life. Well, we sometimes wonder whether we are master of our life as we do various silly things and have silly responses. But we are always master of our life. We are master of our life having these silly things happening to us and the silly responses. The biggest problem in going to school is that you learn what you already know. And you wonder to yourself why you didn't apply it much sooner. You could have applied all of this knowledge that you had much sooner. But like Einstein says, it's too bad that the young people have to have all the good looks and the healthy bodies and youth when us older people would really appreciate it. Now, that is a statement that bears some looking at. Us older people could really have some enjoyment from it. Why don't we just say, I am young, if young is important? Or why don't we just say, I am filled with vitality and enthusiasm? I enjoyed one remark of a lady. I'm not an old lady. I'm just a little girl with wrinkles. And that's it. Why change it? The little girl with wrinkles can be in a very healthy and a very dynamic body. Just because you're older doesn't mean you have to have an old body. And just because you're young doesn't mean you have to have a young body. There are some children who have some diseases that make them age very quickly. And you see, age is not a matter of youth or years or non-years. It's a matter of some gene activity going on in the body. Well, what the heck is this gene activity going on in the body that can make you age when you're a little child? What is that? That might be something scientists might like to investigate. Well, let's you and I investigate it right now. I'm the master of my life, and I choose to have a vital, dynamic, vigorous body and vigorous mind and vigorous life as I go along. Ellen visited the hospital yesterday. She's always going into the hospital brightening up people's lives. But she went into the hospital, and who did she see? But she saw a little old lady lying in the bed next to Ingeborg. And she said, hello. But before she could get the hello out of her mouth, the little lady says, hello, who are you? And Ellen said, my goodness. And she explained who she was. So the little lady chose to have beautiful, dark brown hair, was it? Beautiful, dark brown hair. And the little lady perhaps had been to the plastic surgeon and had a few facelifts or something, or maybe not. Ellen says probably not. She was just a dynamic little lady. But she had problems. She had problems. Her problem was that her mind was so active, she, in her hospital bed, had to be making phone calls to her business and to her world and setting it up. She had to set up the program. What did she do for her people? She got them through sports games and things like that. And she had to be on top of all the sporting activities and do this from her office. And she had a staff that worked with her. But she came to the hospital for some little rejuvenation thing, and then, of course, she would be home the next night. She said, I don't want to go home tonight. I want to go home in the morning because I want to stay here and have a good night's sleep. I don't want to shift in the middle of the night and then not get a good night's sleep. She said, because I've got things to do tomorrow morning. And so Ellen was smiling at her and thought, my, isn't she a dynamic woman? She perhaps was in her 50s, maybe, you know, and maybe early 60s, but 50s. And then Ellen said, well, you certainly are a dynamic lady. How old are you? And she says, I am 82 years old. Well, now, why not be full of life, vitality, be full of everything, spit and vinegar, when you're 82? We had Dorothea Zimmerman, one of our students and one of our ministers. She came here for a week or two or three with us. Five weeks? Is that long? My goodness, it seems just like it's overnight. But she was with us for 5 weeks. And she was running around here in our golf carts, and she was dashing here and dashing there. She had hurt her knee when she came, so it slowed her down a little bit. And so she used a walker and she used a cane, and nothing stopped her from being mobile. She was on her feet and going. Oh, she liked to play the game a little bit when people started being nice to her and started, you know, well, let me help you. Let me help you with this. And she did. And then all of a sudden, after I kicked her in the butt, I said, don't do that. Don't let those people help you. If you let those people help you, you're going to be dependent on them. And when you go home to your apartment on the second floor, dashing up and down the stairs and things like that, you won't be very happy when you're not in good condition. And so she stopped letting people help her so much. A little bit she kind of enjoyed. But she was in our swimmix, swimming her head off, or arms off, or whatever she's doing. And she was in the jacuzzi just soaking up that 100 or 101 degree heat, just loving it to pieces. And she would sit on the bicycles, and she would sit on the pushmobile. She would sit on all these things. But she was just an active, dynamic lady. Her mind was filled with so many wonderful things, and she was eager to get back to her project. Her project was taking goodies to aged people in their home. She'd stop at the bakery that always gave them the day-old sweets, and then she'd take it around to her friends who were the aged people and brighten up their day with a little bit of sweetness and help to kill them a little faster. But really, that's what it is, you know. All that sugar in your system and no movement, you just get pickled. And you're ready to be put away. You do half of the embalming job for the funeral parlor. Well, I am master of my life. And that's what we want to be, is master of our life. We look at people like Dorothea, and we look at people like this lady, 82-year-old lady next to Ingeborg. By the way, Ingeborg is back on the ranch now, doing really fine. And but you look at these people, and you think to yourself, my goodness, where do they get all this fire and spit and vinegar? Well, they get it because they love themselves. They get it because they're master of their life. They get it because they choose to live a dynamic, wholesome, beautiful life. And really, that's quite important. I read an article in Spirituality and Health magazine yesterday, just part of it, about Socrates. And it's a very fascinating article. This young man in New York City felt that he'd like to play the role of Socrates. He had gone to Greece and Rome and Athens, and he had seen where Socrates lived and worked and acted. And he came back and he says, I'm going to pretend I'm Socrates. So he took off his shoes and he put on one of these robes that the Athenians wore in those days, you know, came down to your knees maybe. He let it come a little longer because he didn't think he had such good-looking legs. And he wore a medallion around his throat, and he wore one of these things you wear when you go skiing that cover your ears, you know. He wore that around the top of his head. And all these, and then, of course, his robe had the marks on it that the Athenians had in those days. Well, he went around pretending he was Socrates, asking people questions. And most people just said, I haven't time. And they would brush him off, and they would think, what a, you know, New York's full of crazy people. And this is one of them. But then occasionally, he would find people who would stop and answer his question. Because the people felt he was sincere in doing what he was doing, and they were courteous enough to answer his question. They might have felt that he was crazy, and they were just sort of making him feel a little better in his cuckoo-ness, you know. But they answered his questions. And after answering his questions, they said, you know, that's really something to think about. He asked them questions like Socrates would have asked his students. But in the process of all this, he learned about Socrates. He learned that Socrates was not really a deep thinker, a man who was into deep politics and into deep issues. He was into the person. Socrates was into the individual. He didn't really care about politics. He didn't care about government. He didn't care about any of those things per se. He was aware of it. He wasn't stupid. There wasn't that much politics going on. But he knew it. But what he was aware of was, how did a man think? How did a person come to their conclusions? And how are they master of their life? And this was the conclusion this young man came to. He had been a Socrates aficionado for years and years and years, and he followed the teachings of Socrates and the writings of Plato, and he read all of the things about him, but they all seemed so deep and so intrinsic and so uninteresting, just really uninteresting. They were good, they were things that a philosopher might really probe into, but they weren't exciting. And then this man began to read the life of Socrates, how he was the son of a stonemason, how his father had been a stonemason, and he went on into the army and he did these various things. But then he thought, my job, my life work, is to interpret philosophy, not to teach philosophy, not to teach other people how to think or anything like that, but find out how other people think. How do they arrive at their conclusions? And how are they the master of their life in whatever they're doing? And so he began going around talking to people. Since he had sufficient funds to take care of himself, he went around talking to people, just letting them share with him their ideas. And then he would question them. His questioning was the profound thing. He questioned them to think, how did they come to that conclusion? Why were they so adamant, or why were they so uninterested in the conclusions they were coming to? How did they think? And when he finished, he had done a marvelous job. He had done a marvelous job. Because the country itself went through a great upheaval. But the minds of the men who lived on were minds of thinkers. The senators, the praetorium, all of the various institutions of that day were scuttled by the plague, which completely destroyed the majority of the people. And they were all starting over again. But the ones who were starting over again were the ones who were the masters of their life, the ones who were thinking for themselves. See, when the Spartans came in and inundated the country, they brought with them all the sicknesses that were common in their country. And the people in Greece and Rome were not immune to them. And it was called a plague, which it destroyed the majority of the country, majority of the people. But it's wonderful, because they had a chance to start over again. It's sort of like the flood and Noah. Noah lived in a time when the world was pretty good. People lived long lives and did beautiful things. But they were not pure in consciousness. They had no direction, no goal. They thought they were superior to all, instead of being superior within. And the country, the world of Noah's day, was such that it needed a cleansing. And so the flood was the cleansing. Now, throughout history, times come of a cleansing. The Tower of Babel was built as a time of cleansing, where the people all spoke different languages. And the ones who were the master of their life led their own language people into their own success. But what about you? What about me? Where do we stand on this? How do we think about being the master of our life? We know of the 82-year-old lady, dynamic, forceful, fantastic. She might die tomorrow, who cares? But she's living today. And we know about Dorothea Zimmerman, our dynamic, wonderful teacher, who went through hell. She came out of the fire, and then they remodeled her, and she's beautiful. But she's beautiful because she's beautiful within her soul. And her outer shines that forth too. She's mastered her life. Now, each of us have hang-ups that we have grown up with, that we have had in our past, in our history, in our life, in our home, in our world, where people have said to us, "You're not any good. You're not so smart. Why don't you be smart like your brother or sister? You know, why don't you be smart like them?" And that's very destructive, very, very belittling. And you say, "Well, that's not so terrible, you know." It's when somebody comes and shoots off your leg and you're without one leg. Well, people who have dreams never let that stop them. One young fellow who wanted to be a pitcher, and he was doing just great. And then he fell off the wagon, and his right arm went into the wagon wheel and had to be amputated above the elbow. And he thought his dream of the major league days was over. But he decided no. He used his left arm, which was not his normal arm. He taught it how to pitch. He taught it how to catch. He would flip the glove under his arm and throw with his hand and pitch that way. And then he'd flip the glove out from under his arm and get it on his fingertips and catch the ball. He was good, because his handicap made him all the more intensive in his training of himself. And he's very good. And then one day, after having been in the area of baseball for a long time, he was invited to go to the major league, and he was very good. Now, it doesn't matter what calamity befalls us. It only matters what our attitude is about whatever comes to our life. And are you and I, are we ready to walk that perfect path of being the master of ourselves, being the master of our life? Or are we going to say, "Boo-hoo, I had this problem, and my wife left me, my dog left me, my cow left me," you know? Well, you know the story of Jack and the Beanstalk. Jack's mother was rather a stupid lady. She gave her son the job of selling the cow and bringing home the money. Well, the son wasn't all that togetherness in his head, and so he allowed himself to be sold or given magic beans for the cow. And so he came home, and the mother said, "Oh my goodness, what have you done?" And so he took them out and he planted them. He says, "We'll have beans at least." And of course, the bean grew into the beanstalk. You see, nothing ever takes place in our life that doesn't have with it some great and marvelous experience that's going to come to us. Mark was building his ultralight engines and ultralight airplanes and just having a ball. Never really too enthused about it, but he loved it. Now, his creative genius is going into designing airplane engines. And you say, "Well, why is he designing airplane engines? There's plenty of those around." Not like his. And he is designing them, and he has a new enthusiasm for life, a new drive for life. A magic man. Many other factors are in play there, which we don't need to mention, because we don't need to empower something that he is being totally master of. But you see, he's being totally master. And my wife called and said I should give her brother a call. His birthday is the next day. And I said, "Why? I haven't talked to your brother now for 40 years. Why should I call him on his birthday?" And she says, "Well, for me." And I said, "Well, that's a good reason." So I called him. But before I called him, she had to tell me that he had certain operations and he had certain conditions, and he only has a little time left. Well, I talked to her on the phone. And she said, yeah, sure. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I feel great. I feel wonderful. He sounded very youthful, very dynamic. And then that lousy, lousy brother-in-law, brother of hers, he said, he's 6 feet tall, just like me. And he's trying to get his weight under control. And he tells me that he weighs 185 pounds and he's overweight. And I'd love to be overweight like that, you know, just love it. But you see, the poor guy, he's got problems. He's not concerned about the operations he's had. He's not concerned about the various things that he's experienced. He wants to get a few more pounds off. I mean, he's a magic man. 8 kids, 36 grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, a Mormon, fantastic guy. Fantastic guy. I told him, I said, you know, when we, Faith and I, went to visit you when you were first married and you had your children, you had 4 or 5 of them, it's 8 of them now, and we went into your house and sat there and had dinner with you, it was an experience I'll never forget. Your children were the most mannerly children that I had ever experienced. They were receptive, they were honorable, they said their prayers, each one said some lovely thing at the dinner table. Maybe you trained them to do that just for our coming, I don't know, but it sure was good. And I said, I have never forgotten that, and I said, I have always thought of you and your family from that illustration. He said, well, thank you very much. He said, I'll have to tell my wife that. He said, that's very nice, thank you. You know, but we don't know. Now, I don't know that I had mentioned it to him before, maybe I had, but it's something that's so beautiful that he, though he has 35 grandchildren, you know, and great-grandchildren and what have you, to know that when he was just a young man and his children were just young children, that they made such an impression as to never be forgotten. I'm the master of my life. Are you the master of your life? Do you care? Do you want to live your life so dynamically, so forcefully, so thrillingly, that every moment of your life is exciting? I do. I am. You are. You're in my world. And that's wonderful. And I love you all very, very much. And I am the master of my life. And I see you as the master of your life. I bless you and I love you. And I see everything good in your world.
Thank you. And I think you're already